somebody said, McGowan.
Bill McGowan.
Bill McGowan. Somebody said to me in my first year, did McGowan get you yet? I said, what are you talking about? He said, McGowan, has he said anything or, you know, whatever? Made something out of what you're doing? He says, no. He says, he will. He will. So Red Rolfe grounded out, the ball thrown over to first base, and he hollered into me and said, Tom, look at the ball. You heard that. Tom, look at the ball. You're supposed to say to the umpire, take a look at the ball to see whether it's dirty or not. So I said to McGowan, look at the ball. And he said, what? I said, look at the ball, inspect the ball. He says, you want to look at that ball? I says, yeah, look at the ball. He says, you can't look at that ball. Only I can look at that ball. And I said, well, would you look at the doggone ball then? Now that's what, you know, you got to know that I'm in charge out here. What do you think of that ego? That's what I thought of mine. No. And now I said, cross. I'd go to hell and back for a guy like Bill Summers, an umpire, or Cal
Hubbard.
Cal Hubbard. Criminy sakes, live and let live. They didn't have any trouble. Nestor Shylock, they're putting him in the World Series, the Hall of Fame now. I told guys, I said, I'll take Nestor Shylock. Why? I said, I'll give you 100-1 odds that if he's umpiring home plate, there won't be an incident all day long. Why do you say that? I said, because all he does is come out here and umpire. That's what he does. You never heard of Shylock being in any trouble. With Cal Hubbard, when I love this. Crap sakes, I'm in a slump, and every stinking close pitch is called strike. And I'm this one could if I got a belly full of this. I ain't getting any calls at all. And the pitch comes in, and I take it. That's a ball. And that's 3-1. Now I'm in charge. Hubbard says strike 2. And I blow my top and I get out of there. Doggone it, it's a stinking fat up in this darn stuff. Every doggone pitch is a strike. Why in the heck am I doing this? About 20 seconds, ranting and raving. Cal Hubbard says, okay, Tommy, let's get back into the ball game. I laughed. That's what he should say. You got cooled off? Well, let's get back into the ball.
Hubbard is in the Football Hall of Fame?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I guess he was a big guy.
Yeah.
I guess you probably were thrown out of the game on occasion.
No.
Never?
Never. How could you dislike umpires so much and not get thrown out? The fact that I dislike him doesn't mean that I have to be dumb enough to swear at him. Imagine when I ever got thrown out either.
Do you keep in touch with any ex-players?
No. I get a big kick out of talking with them when I see them, but I don't write letters and nobody writes me.
Did you play in any old-timer games?
Oh, I played in a lot of them, but I haven't played recently.
And what would you say the major differences are today with today's game is when you played it? Naturally, the salary.
That's tough. I watch a little baseball. I'm not sure or whether I'm smart enough to know if there are changes in the game. I don't know.
When did you start following baseball as a spectator?
When they had their strike.
You? Oh, my God.
I don't give a doggone about it.
Did you mean the 81 strike?
No.
Or the 94 strike?
The 94.
Oh my God, that turned you off that much?
Absolutely. Because to me, So you can see how much I enjoyed my life with all of the guys that I met, and I appreciate knowing, and it gives me a heck of a lot of pleasure how good the Lord has been for me to be in a profession that I loved everything about it, and it's been a joy for me all the way. And I don't need what's going on now. I don't. Money. I don't begrudge these guys, the players, making money. But when they take the sport out of baseball, you're not talking to me anymore. I say, I enjoy myself, and look at the violence. What, for instance, in the American League especially, when the pitchers don't come up, and they knock guys down. Now, what kind of a sport is that? Just answer that now. What kind of a sport do you call that? When for some reason or another, they let pitchers get away with that, and have the umpire say, oh, he didn't mean that, he didn't mean that. Who was talking to me about Charlie Berry? It was one of the guys that I was talking with today. He's talking about Charlie Berry, how great he was. And crap sakes, I couldn't stand Charlie Berry. Hey, here's a good story. Your boy, Gordon, we're in spring training in Panama in 46. Joe and I are talking about some crazy thing or another. And we get, he says, hey, Tom, I got one for you. We got a ball game, and the guy hits one into the seats, and he drops dead between first and second. What do you call that? So we argue about that. What is that? Is that a home run, or did he call him out because he didn't run all the way around? So we don't know. We can't make up our mind what to call it. It's just, let's ask Charlie Berry. He's the umpire that we had down in Panama. So we go over, and we present this thing to him. And I don't know whether he said it's a home run or an out. Oh, I think he said it's a home run. And we say, why? The law says he's got to carry it. And this is the gist of the whole thing. Charlie Berry says, now don't forget, he's a college graduate. He's in the Hall of Fame. He's no dumb guy, right? Charlie Berry says, I'd call it a home run. I said, why? He had to do so and so. And here is his answer. He says, you can't make a traversity out of the game. Charlie Berry. And I looked at him, Hall of Fame.
That's a good one.
Before I think of that, that's a funny year.
And I looked at him as a college graduate, my boy. You can't make it to worse.
Tommy, that's all the questions I have. Anything
okay.
else you care to say?
No, I'm about to talk myself out. Well, ask him why in 36 what turned that thing upside down, and because they were fighting Cleveland, and they played a big series in Cleveland. I was there, and I said, and you went out to Cleveland in this big series, and it seemed like you kind of took over. And Lazari said to me, I didn't know Lazari up to now. He says, like you say, he says, this is a big series. We go out to Cleveland, we're ready, we get out there, we're going to play Cleveland. And he says, they quit on us. He's mad because Cleveland gave in to him. They went out there to cream them, and they quit. This is Lazari, okay? And I gotta believe him. He was tough. You don't think you're ever gonna hear that kind of stuff.
Tell me, what made McCarthy's team so tough to beat?
I think the the very fact that everybody on our ball club was in cahoots with the way McCarthy ran a show. And I tell you, and a lot of guys said, was it a big thrill for you to see Yankee Stadium? I said, not as big as being in that clubhouse when I shook hands with that ball club. Believe you me, they shook hands. Businessmen all the way cordially greeted me and so forth. That takes care of that. Now let's go to work. That's the big deal.
McCarthy was the best manager you had.
That's right. And I'll tell you, Ted Williams would take McCarthy. Bertie Tebbets would take McCarthy. There are no dumb guys. And I got more guys that revered Joe McCarthy than anybody else. Yeah. So, what the heck? I can live without the agents and owners and $12 million ball players. And if you want them, go ahead. You'll allow me the privilege of not liking it.
I was going to ask the two major leaguers that were out there talking to us at 2:30 and 4 o'clock. And I'm going to ask you, it seems like the minor leaguers are underpaid, and it seems to me like they're forgotten about. And when the ball players went on strike, I noticed they didn't care whether the minor leaguers got a better deal or not. You know, they cared whether they could make $8 to $10 million
a
year.
That's a good observation.
You know, but they...
That's a darn good observation.
And it just seems to me that somewhere along the line, the ball players ought to say, you know, look, I spent 6 years in the minors. I didn't make a damn thing in the minors. You know, one of my pals I left behind is still there, and he's not making anything. And it seems like the professionals don't really seem to
care. Yeah, it almost looks like that. Now that I made the majors and I'm getting my millions, and you guys can go your own way. I don't have any regard for you. As I say, that's you can have it. I don't need it.
Did you ever have like a son who got active?
No, I got two sons, and neither one of them. I didn't push them. I had three brothers. I had three brothers and two of them. No, I had four brothers, and three of them cared about playing ball, and the fourth one didn't. How are you gonna account for that? My dad, Crossy, was tickled to death. My dad was not a bad ball player, but his father, Philip Henrich, German all the way. You tell him that your son is gonna play ball to make a living. No German would say, oh no, we don't play ball to make a living. As a matter of fact, Dad said to my grandfather now, he went over and told him, he says, Tom's gonna make, he's gonna play professional baseball. And Grandpa Henry says, oh, he's got soul. And he says, I think this is cute. Grandpa Henry says, what's he see? The striker? To Grandpa Henry, one of the guy hits the ball. No more, no football. That's a smartest thing that ever happened. Heck with it. I enjoy football the way it was then, but I don't want any part of it.
Okay. When did you get interested in baseball?
Of course, when I was 5 years old. Okay?
Okay.
I cared about catching something and hitting something when I was five. Softball, when I was six, when I went to first grade. St. Mary's School, my brother Eddie was in the fifth grade, and I sat during the recess time and said, let me play. And the guys said, oh, you're too young, you can't play. And Eddie says, he can play. So I played right then. In other words, I liked playing ball at that time, and it kept on going.
Did you always play the outfield?
No, I played all over.
And what was your favorite team in the majors growing up?
New York Yankees. I remember at age 8, Babe Ruth was traded to the New York Yankees. And what he amounted to in baseball, it satisfied my, whatever I want to say. I like the, what Babe Ruth was doing to baseball, the slugging that he was going through, and how he was transforming the game of baseball, it suited me fine. And I just cared about the New York Yankees.
How did you get into organized baseball?
Well, I'll take my time here now. I played softball till I was 19. Our team broke up. And let's say in October, and the guy said, well, how would you like to play baseball? I says, all right, I'll give that a whirl. So I joined a team in Maslin the next year. 19, what the heck would it be? Whatever it was. The Prince Horn Dairies, and I played on that team. And along came a big league scout. And I played a game, got 2 base hits off of a guy that he was scouting. And he said in the 8th inning, how would you like to play professional ball? I almost fell over. And I said, if some guy thinks I can play professional ball, I'm going to get serious about this. So I switched teams to a team in my own hometown, Maslin, that practiced, they had batting practice every night. And I says, I got to make up some time here, because up to now I'm a softball hitter. So at any rate, I played there, and another scout saw me and offered me a contract with the Cleveland Indian organization, and I signed up under Billy Evans, he was the general manager, and I went away the following spring, 1934.
Is that Billy Evans, the same former umpire?
That's the guy, yeah. We were very good friends. And I played Class D ball in Manassas, Pennsylvania. Class, Pennsylvania State League.
Right, 1934.
That's right. Next year they advanced to Zanesville Ball Club in the Mid-Atlantic League, still under Cleveland ownership. And I played there that year. In 1936, I advanced to New Orleans in the Southern Association.
You had a very good year there.
You're darn right I did. I played, the only time in my life, I played every second of every ball game in that humidity.
That's right. You led the league in games played, 157.
That's right.
And total bases, 328. 346.
That's it.
Okay, so that was 1936.
Right.
Okay. Now we go to 1937.
Okay.
And you ended up in Newark, which was the Yankee farm.
I wrote to, during the course, I was presumably sold from New Orleans to Milwaukee. 2 farm clubs of the Cleveland Indians. During the winter, I read where Milwaukee's going to sell me to the Boston Braves, and the Indians are going to trade me to the St. Louis Browns, which means I belong to 2 ball clubs. Right? You can't do that. So I wrote to Judge Landis. He looked into it. He declared me a free agent, and I had 8 ball clubs that were interested in me, and when I found out the Yankees was one of them, that's the ball club I went to. That was not a hard decision. My father said, now they're the world champions at the end of 36.
Right.
He says, you think you can make that ball club? I said, Dad, I don't know. But by George, if I'm going to be a good ball player, I don't want to be with the St. Louis Browns. So I took a chance and went to the Yankees.
Did you ever meet Judge Landis?
Yeah. Good friend of mine. Oh, God.
Was he as stern and crusty as they say?
Yes, because all he wanted was truth. It's a fact. You see these pictures of him?
White hair.
The white hair, and leaning forward, looking at, looking straight through you. If you were telling the truth, he was your friend. And boy, if you weren't, you're in for it.
Okay, so you came out to the Newark Club in 1937. Well, now, that was a pretty good team, wasn't it, that per minor league?
They won the pennant by 27 games. I went to the Yankees. I was there for 2 weeks. I wasn't in a ball game. McCarthy shipped me over to Newark. I'll make it short. I was there for 10 days, played 7 games. I hit 744, or 740. Okay? 440. Okay. McCarthy called me back to, and I joined the ball club in Chicago, played one game there, 4 games in St. Louis, 3 in Philadelphia. Now we're going back to New York, where that's the first game I played for the Yanks in New York.
So you're on the team, but you hadn't played any games yet until New York.
When they shipped me over to Newark, I hadn't played one inning with the Yankees.
But when you came back?
Then I played.
Okay. What's your impression? Do you remember your first game?
Yeah. It's in Chicago. The umpire's name was 5 letters, starts with a B. That doesn't make any difference because the first time at the plate, Ball 1, ball 2, I'm looking for the hit sign from Art Fletcher. I ain't hitting. They got me taken. That's number one that I didn't like. It's a fastball down the middle, 2-1. The next ball was a curveball, 2-2. The next ball was a curveball inside, and I took it. That's the first time I disagreed with the umpire because he called me out. And I still say it was a bad ball. So that's my first time at the plate. I got a double in the ball game, so I got one base hit.
So you got a hit in your first game then?
Yeah, I got a hit in the left field.
What kind of salary did you make at that time?
$5,000.
Was that the minimum or was that?
That's more than some other guys made. Yeah.
So it was not the minimum then, actually. Did they have a minimum in those days?
Do you know that Branch Rickey in 1934 paid some of the gas house gangs $300 a month? Multiply that by 6, they made $1,800 if they were lucky. So when I got $5,000, I was a plutocrat.
Were the Yankees known for paying pretty well? No.
They were paying for what the heck you could fight for. With an easy-going barrel, that's what Gomez called Ed Barrel. Easy-going barrel, yeah. He'd get you for nothing if he could.
Okay. Well, in 37, you played in 67 games, and you hit 320.
Yeah.
Now, you didn't play in the World Series, though, even though the Yankees
did. I hurt my knee in August or July. My left knee tore cartilage, and I was down to pinch hit. That's what happened.
But you weren't able to, they didn't need you in the World Series.
They sure didn't.
did you get a partial, I guess you got at least a partial share.
I got a full share.
Get a full share.
Yeah.
Okay, in 38, you played pretty much the whole year.
Yeah.
The whole year. Who did you displace in the outfield?
Well, when I joined the Yankees, they got rid of Roy Johnson. McCarthy got rid of Roy Johnson because some stupid thing that Roy Johnson said. And McCarthy got rid of him. That's how I got back with the Yankees. Now, in 38, who did they get rid of?
Tom, why don't you tell them what Roy Johnson said?
Well, okay. That's how I got the Yankees. The Yankees got beat 2 ball games in Detroit, in a row, in 37. McCarthy came into the clubhouse, I guess in a bad mood, losing 2 in a row, and his mood must have been that, let's get going here, whatever, so forth. And Roy Johnson, an outfielder, was the half-brother of Bob Johnson, Big Bob with the A's. He heard this, and he said, "What's that guy expect to do, win every day?" And yeah, McCarthy did expect to win every day. McCarthy went to the phone, got a hold of Ed Barrow in New York City. He says, "Get rid of Roy Johnson and send me that kid from Newark." That's where I was. And Ed Barrow said, "Well, I'll see what I can get for Roy Johnson." And McCarthy says, "I don't care what you get for him. Get him out of here, and I want that kid from Newark." Okay? More, he wanted to get Roy Johnson than he did to have me. So that's how I really got back the Yanks. So that's the end of that outfielder. And as far as 38 is concerned, I'm not sure when Merle Hogue left or somebody else, but eventually I took over regular in the outfield.
Had Charlie Keller come up yet then?
No, he came up 39.
39 next year. Okay.
With a roar.
King Kong.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, of course, you played the outfield with DiMaggio.
Yes.
Were you particularly, I mean, was he aloof or friendly or just, did you have any kind of relationship with him or any of the other players?
DiMaggio was not an outgoing guy. We never had one word of dissension between us. He is not an outgoing guy, and when I run into a guy that's not outgoing, I don't bubble over either. So that was our relationship. I admired DiMaggio the way he played ball, and I was doggone glad I was on his side, because he's the best ball player I ever saw. And I appreciate seeing him. I'll tell you a little story. I'm with New Orleans in 36. We got a pitcher there that had been with DiMaggio in San Francisco, Seals, the year before. Jimmy Densmore. He's now a pitcher for, he wasn't a good pitcher. He was at it. But every morning for breakfast, I got Joe DiMaggio. He said, "Well, I got to see what my boy did yesterday." What he's telling me is DiMaggio every day. He was a superstar, and my feeling about this whole thing, ain't nobody can be that good. Every day he would tell me this about DiMaggio, not realizing at the end of 36, I'm going to be a free agent and play ball next to Joe DiMaggio the following year. And I found out that he was as good as Densmore had him painted to be. Okay, and I never went downhill. How good he was!
Who did you room with on the road?
Well, the first guy I roomed with was Coach Earl Combs.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Old center fielder.
Yeah, that a boy. That's true. And I roomed with Gomez a little bit, not much.
Was he as flaky as he?
I can talk for hours about Lefty Gomez. He's one of a kind. He's a great guy. I enjoy it. Million laughs. Oh, and you wonder, was he a clown? You know, his original name was Goofy. They called Gomez more Goofy Gomez as a youngster for the Yankees than Lefty. But when that ball in his hand in a big ball game, nothing goofy about that guy. Matter of fact, Joe McCarthy was asked one time, "You think of the toughest ball game you got to play and all the pitchers you've had, who would you give the ball to the pitch?" McCarthy was not a, he wasn't a flighty guy. You ask him a question, he thinks it over, and he'll answer you. And he thought this question over, and he ended up saying, "I'd give the ball to Gomez." What do you think of that? For the biggest ball game, McCarthy wants Gomez. Now that's a pretty good compliment.
He had a very good World Series record.
Oh, I'll say. Yes, sir.
Now, when you came up in 37, of course, Gehrig was still with the team.
Yeah.
And I guess that was probably his last good, decent year.
It wasn't, 38 wasn't bad. You see, it wasn't a Gehrig year, but it was not bad. Cross, take a look at his total. It wasn't one of his better years, but never in 37, 38, never did we say that Gehrig is going downhill. It wasn't there. What I'm talking about is there are no appearances of Gehrig suffering from disease. He may be suffering from being 35 or 36, but you can't say he's suffering from polio or whatever.
Okay, and he obviously was respected. I guess he was a captain and well respected.
He didn't act like the captain. He looked upon him as the leader and so forth. He didn't want any part of being the captain. There was never one sign out of Gary. Don't forget, I'm the captain of the ship. Yeah, he wasn't there. I love Lou Gehrig. He's live and let live. And I'm happy to say I feel that Lou Gehrig liked me. I got along fine with him. I would go to him every time I'm facing a new pitcher. What do I look for, Lou? And he would tell me. Now, that ain't a bad relationship, is it? But that's Lou with me.
Right. Now, in 38, the Yankees won the pennant again.
Yeah.
And they played the Cubs in the World Series.
That's right.
Okay. And you got a chance to face Dizzy Dean?
You can't believe Dizzy Dean pitching in a World Series game with what he had. Listen to me. He had absolutely nothing left in his arm. I faced him three times, he got me out. And the fourth time I went up in the ninth inning, I said, apparently this guy doesn't have anything. And I waited and waited and hit a line drive into right field. I think DiMaggio found out the same thing, because DiMaggio hit one over the left wheel wall in the ninth inning. Instead of 4-3, now it becomes 6-3. And I admired Diz Dean having the gall to get out there and pitch him a ball game like that.
Okay. And 1939, Yankees won the pennant again.
Yeah.
And once again, unfortunately, you didn't play in the World Series. What was the problem?
I would say the truth of the matter is Selkirk had a darn good year. Better than I was having.
Twinkleton.
And you're not going to get Charlie out of the lineup. Keller had a super year and a super World Series. He butchered the Cincinnati Reds. Hit three home runs and did all kind of damage to them. That's true. I was on the sideline. George McCarthy says, Selkirk's playing better than you were.
All right.
Might as well tell the truth.
Right.
What kind of rookie year did Charlie have that year?
Oh, I don't know his numbers. But damaging. Oh, God. He was afraid of nothing, and he hit a lot of balls through the middle. I think if McCarthy had not made Charlie into a pull hitter, which Charlie did not agree with 100%, but he took it from McCarthy because he was the boss. But I think when Charlie Keller got finished, now listen to this, I think Charlie Keller said, if McCarthy hadn't made me a pull hitter, I think I would have hit 20 points better in the big leagues than I did. So he went along with it, because that's the kind of a guy it was. But that wasn't his style of hitting. He hit more like Gehrig. Gehrig didn't care where he threw the ball. He just belted. And Ducky Medley, that's the way he hit. throw the ball wherever it is, I'll belt it someplace. But McCarthy made Keller a pull hitter because of short right field in Yankee Stadium. And Charlie didn't really agree with it, but he went along with it.
Now, during these first few years, were you getting a raise in salary as you went along, or?
My dear, the answer is no, I didn't get a raise every year. I told a guy today, dealing with Ed Barrow, this is a letter to me. My dear Henry, that's the way he addressed me. My dear Henry, he says, if you're as intelligent as I think you are, you will sign this contract and return immediately.
Another branch, Ricky.
Yeah. That's a good comparison.
Okay. Well, 1940, the Yankees didn't make the pennant, but you had a pretty decent year, 307.
What happened was, I don't know why. Oh, first of all, Gary his disease hits him in 39.
Well, by the way, can we go back just to 39 a minute? That's when he pulled out in Detroit.
Yes.
I guess there wasn't. Was there any kind of indication that he was going to be doing this?
Boy, from the time of spring training on. Oh, genius. He just was incapable of making his body perform. It's not there. Everybody knew there's something wrong with it. In those years, we didn't know what to call it. And so they ended up with, oh, he's got polio. He didn't have polio, but they didn't know about the ALS. They didn't know about that. And they asked, it was so bad that the sports writers were saying to McCarthy, when are you going to take Lou out? And McCarthy says, I'm not going to take him out. He's going to take himself out. And that's what Lou did. He says, I'd better get out of here. I can't do anything, right? I'm not going to hurt the ball club anymore. That's when he got out. Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry, back to 1940, you were telling about the what happened.
Well, I'll say, the New York Daily News had I think they call that a tabloid.
Right.
Tabloid. Okay. The tabloid. The headline was, has polio hit the Yankees? They don't even know what he's got in 1940, all right? Well, what they had was Red Rolfe and Bill Dickey and a couple other guys having a bad year. And it really cost us. We lost, I'm absolutely sure, that in the spring we lost 8 games in a row. And the one series that I recall, we played Detroit, and Hank Greenberg went crazy, and those Jewish guys in New York City, they loved to see Hank destroying the Yankees. And now we're nowhere near first place, and we fought and fought all year long. And we did gain, but we never got to first place. And I would say, I hate to say this, but Red Rolfe and Bill Dickey had bad years. Now they were, very valuable players.
All-star.
And it just so happened that we couldn't lose 2 guys like that and overcome. And there were some other guys that didn't really have good years. I don't know how good Joe was or Charlie, but it should not have happened. It should not have happened. We should have won.
Expect to win every year, right?
Oh yeah, but we had the talent in 40 to win, and we didn't.
Your World Series cuts from the games, that was comparable to your base salary, or was it more?
Depending on how good you were. Well, if you're a rookie and you get $5,000, you can say, well, in the World Series you made as much as you did for the whole year. I'll say this, it was pretty big, your salary, compared to what these guys are today. And even though the World Series cut, what was it, $80,000 or something like that? Well, that's pretty good, but $80,000 compared to $4 million a year. That's not very
right.
So that's a, who cares about that?
Okay, 1941, that Gehrig made the speech at Yankee Stadium. I guess that was a pretty emotional.
It certainly was. It certainly was. There were a lot of tears out there because what a well-loved guy he was and the way he took the whole thing. And when he says, "I'm the luckiest guy in the world," oh, gee, crutch. You hear a guy say that. I saw Lou Gehrig when he weighed about 120. His body had gone downhill. Grantland Rice, Henry McLemore, Bill Dickey, who else? Myself. We went, Earl Combs, we went out to Gehrig's house, and we saw him, and there the guy is in bed. And he was very gracious. And we didn't overstay, and we're going to leave, and I recall this. We said, "Goodbye, boys, thanks for coming out." He said, I had a, the doctor told me the other day I was there, and he said that I got to go downhill all the way, and then my body is going to come back. What do you think of that? And nobody believed that. How are you going to? This guy's going to come back from 120. That was Lou.
Right. Okay, in 41 you guys won the pennant again.
Yeah.
And you had the World Series, the Subway Series sort of, I guess, with the Dodgers.
Yeah, that's right.
And there was a big game four which you had, you played a significant part. You want to lead up to that?
Yeah.
Ninth inning, wasn't it?
Yeah, we're behind 4-3. Two men out, Hugh Casey's pitching, Mickey Owen is the catcher. 3-2 on me, and in comes a high pitch, which was a curveball. It starts to break, and I think it may be called a strike, so I start to swing, and before I get my bat out in front of me, I already know that ball is going to be too low. It goes from me protecting a high pitch to that much, not that little a time later, that I know that doggone ball's keeping on breaking and it's going to be low. And from there on, I try to check my swing and I can't do it. And when my bat gets, when I was about halfway swing, I said to myself, "I know it's bad." At this point, I said, "Going to be bad," and I had to hold my swing up. And then I said, "I'm so doggone fooled on it. Maybe Mickey Owen is fooled on it too." So as I go through with my trying to hold up my swing, and I'm my body had gone straight up, straight ahead. I'm already looking around to see how Mickey Owen is making out on this pitch. And I see the ball bouncing away, which didn't surprise me. So I got to first base, and the ball went all the way to the stands.
So you sort of anticipated that possibility.
Well, when I found out it was going to be a bad ball, and I looked like a dummy up there trying to hit it, and I said, "Gee, maybe Mickey's having trouble." So I got to first base. So what the heck? So what? You're on first base, two men out, all they need is another out, right? Well, they didn't get it because the manager hit a bullet to left field. No chance for me to even get to third. Never even thought about it. So now I'm on second, he's on first,
and
up comes Charlie Kelly. And he's guarding home plate. That's all he's doing. He's guarding home plate on these curveballs that Hugh Casey has thrown, and he lifted a lazy fly ball. And, you know, right field in Brooklyn isn't very deep. It may be 300 or 310 or whatever it is, but it's a lazy fly ball. But it was on the screen. And I'm going to score in a breeze. And DiMaggio is flying. And when the ball comes down, this lazy thing. The chicken wire they got at the top of it bounces off the concrete, which is about 12 inches wide. And when the ball comes down to the bottom, the ball hit the concrete and bounced up in the air. Now there goes at least 2 seconds, right? Stop the ball, bounce up in the air, and then come down. And when it came down, those 2 seconds, now the way DiMaggio was running, that's 50 to 60 feet that he has gone while that ball's bouncing up in the air. And that enabled him to score. He came around third, and Art Fletcher had him, gave him the goal sign, and I'm standing at home plate. I have scored, and here comes DiMaggio. And I want to tell you, the way he flew across home plate, he slid across home plate. He slid across home plate. He says, "I'm gonna make this." You can just see the determination. I'm gonna score, because that's the big one, and it wasn't even close. But it didn't make any difference to him out there. He says, "I'm gonna score on it." Then they walk Dickey. Keller's on second. They walked Dickey to pitch to Gordon. And Gordon hit the left field wall. And the real quiz question is, who is the left fielder for the Brooklyn Dodgers? Go ahead and think.
Wasn't Dixie Walker, was it?
No, he's in right field. Rich, do you know?
You told me.
I told you.
Tell me.
A first baseman. By nature, a first baseman, Jimmy Wasdell, is the first baseman. He's playing left field, and the ball went out and hit the wall, and he was so inept at playing the rebound off the wall that when the ball hit the wall, it went past him on the way back. Now here goes this ball toward the infield, and that enabled Bill Dickey to score. With his lack of speed, he scored all the way from first base because it got past Jimmy Wasdell out there. So then Johnny Murphy got three outs in a hurry. And
that was basically the series.
Oh, yeah. DiMaggio, I remember Big Joe saying that he was, you know, like most everybody felt, they won't come back from this.
Tom, what kind of series did Joe Gordon have?
Oh boy, oh boy. He only hit 500. You know that? I don't think the Yankees hit 200 in that series. And Gordon hit 500. He drove in runs and scored runs. And as low as we hit, the Dodgers hit lower. So that's how much the pitching was in control of that whole series. I hit a home run off of in the last game, Gordon drove in two in about the second or third inning. We're up, and in about the fourth or fifth, thoughts I caught a hold of a fastball and went low wide. And the reason I bring this up is because when I hit home plate and went into the dugout, Red Rolfe, pretty smart cookie, Red Rolfe said to me, "Boy, that's a big run." And I says, "I think so too."
Tommy, what about that summer?
A two-run lead is a heck of a lot more than one.
Yeah. Tommy, what about that summer? What happened then?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Anything about DiMaggio's streak you want to talk about?
Oh!
And Ted Williams, too, for that.
Yeah.
A big year.
Oh, yeah. The best thing that could ever have been said about Ted Williams is hitting over 400. When Cronin said, "Joe, you know, Ted, you can sit out and be a 400 hitter," and Ted says, "The heck with that! I'm going to get in there and be a 400 hitter or not." And what did he do? He
got six for eight.
Six for eight
in that doubleheader.
Beautiful. I heard that. I said, "That up, boy, Ted." And DiMaggio. Well, nobody got excited about DiMaggio. I would say we were in the 30s before the Yankees ball team got serious about Joe, because it was nothing new for DiMaggio to be hitting them 10-year-old, 15-year-old. But when he got up past 30, he says, oh, well. So he got up to 37, and now it's serious. By 37, this because he's now within about 7 or 8 of breaking the American League record. George Sisler and who the other guy is? Well,
Keeler had the National League record.
Keeler,
I think it was 44.
And he was up to 37, and Joe is 0 for 3. We were playing, the pitcher is Eldon Auker.
Oh, the underhand, submarine
ball. And Joe is 0 for 3, and it's the eighth inning, and we're two runs ahead. And I'm the third hitter, and Joe is the fourth. Now, if this game goes in the ninth inning, and St. Louis doesn't score, the game's over, okay? And I'm the next hitter. Red Rolfe is up there. And I said to myself, wouldn't this be something if Rolfe gets on first base and I hit into a double play? That'll be very nice, right? And I had a brainstorm, and I walked over to McCarthy in there and went over to him, because I'm a number three hitter with one out. You don't bunt in that situation. And I went over to McCarthy, I said, Joe, if Red Rolfe gets on first base, will it be all right if I bunt? And McCarthy thought about 3 or 4 seconds and said, that'll be all right. Meaning, I agree with your thinking. Let's go out of our way to let Joe get up there for doggone sure. And that's what happened. I bunted off of Eldon Auker, and Eldon Auker hit the first or second throw he made. The manager belted in left center field, drove him off. And I've been told many times, what would you have done? Hey, supposing Eldon Auker walks the manager. I said, I know Eldon Auker. He's got more class than to take that way out to pitch to Joe DiMaggio. And I could hit, I tell people this, I could hit Eldon Auker without a doubt better than any other pitcher that I ever saw in the big leagues. And I said, the best percentage is just get Joe up there, okay? I hit him so well, Auker. I hit a line drive in the left center field. I was thrown out at second base. And as I run off the ball field, past the pitcher's mound, Eldon Auker said to me, I finally figured out how to get you out. It's a very, he ended up a millionaire, and as far as I know, he's still living. And I got nothing but a soft feeling in my for Eldon Auker. And the Yankees didn't want any part of it. Well, they didn't. We didn't hit it. This is crazy. This is my favorite pitcher, and the rest of the Yankee ball club didn't like me. There was a lot of other pitchers that I could say, I can't hit him, but this one guy was all right.
Well, what happened in Washington?
Oh, yeah.
I guess that's my team.
Now, down to the second game, he tied the record in the first game, and somebody stole his ball back. And I love to tell this because you know the cold-blooded guy DiMaggio is? Not this time. I'm up in the first inning. They get one out, two outs, I'm the next hitter. And I'm going up the home plate. And I hear, and I'll give you the sound that I heard. I'm walking up the home plate and I hear, Tom! Crying, he says, what's this? I turn around, DiMaggio's calling to me. He says, you got my bat. And I walk over to him, I said, Joe, I got one of your bats, but he said, let me see it. And I showed it to him, and then he looked it over and he says, somebody stole my bat. Now, coming out of DiMaggio, that's rare. He's concerned, all right? He went to the plate, he hit a line drive to the right center field for the third out, And as we passed by going to center field, me to right field, just like that, he says, that'd have been my bat, it would have been in there. So he's concerned, right? So he's not satisfied with his ball bat. And I said, Joe, take a look at mine. I'm sure this bat is more like the one you've been using. And he picked it up and said, yeah, it does feel good. He didn't want to use it. I guess he didn't want to break my bat. I don't know why. But he used my bat either the third or fourth time. I think it was the third. He used my bat, line drive base hit. Okay? Now they haven't found his bat, and he used my bat for a week, and they found some Dago guy, young kid in Newark, had swiped the ball bat, and the rest of the Italians over there found out about it, and they said, this bat's got to go back to Big Joe. And they did it. They brought it over to the stadium. He had it by next Sunday. That's when Joe went back to his original bat and finished the rest of the way.
Okay, 1942. You won the pennant again.
Yeah.
But you ran into the Cardinals that year in the World Series.
Well, the only reason they got beat there because I was in the Coast Guard.
Now, why don't you tell them when you left the Yankees?
Well, you played 127 games that year.
Yeah, I left the Yankees, but the first, I was, the service called me on about the 1st of September, around that time. So I wasn't there when they got beat.
Tom, what about your last at-bat before you went to the Coast Guard?
Oh, boy. Dizzy Crowd is pitching Detroit. When I went up to home plate, they knew the Yankees. I told them so that they could get a ball player for World Series by the 1st of September. I think the law is that the guy's got to be there.
Got to be on the roster.
And I told them, I said, this is my last game. We're calling into the service. So they announced, ladies and gentlemen, this will be Tommy's last appearance as a Yankee ball player for the duration of the war. Well, gee, goodness, cuts. They gave me a beautiful. The pitcher for the Tigers, Paul Dizzy Trout. And they give me applause. And I'm embarrassed about the thing, and I want to come, all right, let's go. And they're still applauding. And I look out to Dizzy, I said, come on, let's go. He says, no, Tom. He says, this happens once in a lifetime. Take it. Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
That's what he did. More to come. Now I'm going to hit a ball to the moon for these fans, right? And I swing and miss. And then there's ball, whatever. And in comes the next one. And I say, well, I'll do it this time. And I swing and miss. And they got the 3-2, and I said, never mind hitting it to the moon. Hit the blooming ball someplace, okay? So I protected it a little bit, and I hit a screaming, beautiful line drive to center field for a base hit. And I've said to a lot of people, don't you ever tell me anything against Dizzy Trout. He gave me 6 fastballs to hit, and I'm a fastball hitter. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, got the last one.
Yeah.
Okay, what'd you do in the service? Did you play ball?
Oh, yeah, I did. I played in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. I was the manager of the ball club. And I told Jimmy Dykes this. I see Dykes. I was in Detroit on a day off. And he said, what are you doing? I told him, I'm playing ball. I'm the manager of the team up in Sault Ste. Marie. And he said, how are you doing? I said, well, I've just convinced myself that you could have a left-handed shortstop. He said, get out of here. He said, get out of here. I don't want to hear you talk. And that's what I did, though. I played shortstop for this ball club. And I was as good as any other guy around there. But that's what I did in the service.
Played for the troops, I guess.
No, We didn't have it. You mean on the road?
Yeah.
We didn't have it. We had a ball club, but we didn't play anybody. Locally and so forth. And I was the manager.
Including the Red Sox.
Mm-hmm.
And you to 251, a little probably below par for you.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have much trouble getting back in the swing of things after?
I'll tell you, I didn't feel badly, but I didn't produce. So it's unknown to me why I didn't have a decent year, because I felt healthy and so forth. But it's just something beyond me. Knowing why, and the same with DiMaggio. He hit 290, first time in his life, and we just didn't have the Red Sox took the starch out of us, because I recall early in the year, we started to get turned around, and I think we got on a winning streak of about 11 games. And we're getting straight out for winning ball games. But while we did that, the Red Sox won four more in a row than we did. So they picked up four games while we're winning 10 or 11 in a row. So it's their year, and it just kept going. And I know one thing. Rudy Ark was the first baseman, and Rudy Ark told me, he says, "You know something, Tom? You know we're going to win this pennant, don't you?" I says, "Yeah, I know that." He says, "We got guys on this ball club that aren't sure that we're going to win." Yeah, no, all I know is that that's what Rudy Ark told me. Rudy Ark was he was no dumb Indian, I'll tell you that.
McCarthy was still manager, right?
Yeah. And McPhail let him go next year.
He went to the Red Sox, right?
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. We changed base. He left in 46 because Bill Dickey became the manager, and then Johnny Nee finished up the last 2 weeks. So it was a debacle on the whole ball club. And I never forgave letting me fail for getting rid of McCarthy. Jesus Christ, that's like getting rid of God.
Tom, why was McCarthy so good?
I think because he understood the psychology of a ball player. For sure, when you're in a slump, McCarthy was your best friend. And when you're playing good ball and you get a little gay in your playing, boy, he'd be all over you. Okay? So he understood. And he knew when you were pressing and so forth. That's what I said. And I'll reveal something to you. Ted Williams became a manager. Remember that?
Yeah, the Senators in 69.
Okay. He called Joe McCarthy three times during the year. For what? He wanted McCarthy to explain to him, why do you do this? Why do you play this way in the major leagues? And McCarthy told, I said, how I know this, McCarthy told me. And he said to Ted, he says, "What are you calling me for?" And Ted says, "Because I want to get it from you, because I know you know it, and I don't want other managers to know that I'm asking somebody their advice and why do you do this?" He says, "I want to know the right, why do you do it? And I don't want them to know it."
Okay. When we come to 1947,
yeah,
and you're back in the pennant business. When Bucky Harris is the manager,
yeah,
Now, Houston, of course, Bucky had been around all year. I know he played for the Senators, and he managed the Senators several times.
Yeah.
What did you think of Bucky?
Well, he was a, in a case like a veteran, like I was at that time. Now I've been there for 10 years. He would give you credit for knowing how to play ball. If you wanted to do it, as a matter of fact, one time, especially, we're in a tough ball game, and Krauser got a couple men on, and you're wondering, which way does the manager want you to go? So I went back to the dugout, and I said, Bucky, what do you want me to do? He said, Tom, you do whatever you want to do. I said, can't picture McCarthy ever saying that. I'll tell you what I want you to do. And I recall the man on first and second, and I want, the play is I should bunt, advance these two guys, but I don't want to bunt. I said, what are you going to do? Mickey Owen is the guy on first. He's the first baseman. And I wanted to finagle a little bit, and first pitch comes in, and I drag like I'm dragging the ball. I ain't going to drag the ball. But I made like I am dragging it so that Mickey will come in a little bit. If he's going to bunt, I better get in there a little bit. And he did. He came in a little bit. It was ball. I can do the same thing again, right? And I did get Mickey to come in. Now, I can't tell you what I did. All I can tell you, I think I did a smart thing on playing a percentage, getting Mickey in here so now I can hit one by him, okay? I don't remember what happened, but all I know is that in answer to you, how was Bucky? He said, you do what you want, and I did what I wanted. But I hope I could say that I hit one between the first baseman, second baseman, but I don't remember.
Well, you had a pretty good year that year, 287, and yeah. You led the league in triples, 13.
I could speed up on it. A lot of guys would say, you were you led the league in triples. No way. Well, I did, after 46, I did reach a point where I guarded home plate a lot better. And that was the result. The guy tried to fool around with not pitching me inside. I go with him a little bit better. And a lot of the time, I ended up batting second, which is accountable for instead of me going for the distance, a home run, that I would hit it around and get more guys in scoring position. I think that had something to do with it.
And then the World Series that year, 47.
Oh. That was a dandy. So Bucky Harrison, I remember, we talked about a World Series of 7 games. He said, those are the only kind I've ever been in.
The Senators, 24 and 25, right, yeah, 7 games each.
He's the only kind of series I've ever been in. Bucky is a good guy, very good guy.
Now,
that was an hard fought.
That was the year that Cookie Lavagetto broke up the no-hitter. Was it Bevins?
Bevins, that's right.
But you guys came back. And then after Gianfrido caught the long haul of DiMaggio.
Tell me what you're telling about Lavagetto's hit.
Well, first of all, you gotta get dressing in here, Up comes Lavagetto, pinch hit. I look at DiMaggio, he looks at me, what do we do with this guy? We don't know. And nobody in there telling us whether the shading to the left or the right or whatever. So we played him more or less straight away. And he hit the ball to my left, okay? To my left. And as soon as he hits it, I know the ball is going. I got a feeling the ball's going to go at least to the wall. And the ball goes through the white shirts in about a second or less. And he comes out, and as soon as I see it, I can't catch the ball. It's going to get by me before I can get to the wall. It was a line drive. And about that time, I said, you can't catch it, so back off the wall so that you get a better look at it. And I did. I give up on crowding the ball, going after the ball, because here's the situation. If the ball can be caught and I'm backing off the wall, there goes the no-hitter. That's a nice thing to do. Give up on the world, the no-hitter. On the other hand, if I charge the ball and it is too high and it gets by me going in there, Mix is going to score from first. There's a nice position, right? You heard me say, there's 10 seconds of my life I don't need anymore. That's a bad. I'm stuck. And the ball came off the wall. It was about chest high. Came off the wall. I did a pretty good job, better than Wasdell, because he lost the ball.
Went back to
the infield. He came back and hit the palm of my glove and dropped. When it dropped, now I got, and I'm pulling off the wall. Now I have to go back and get it. And when I pick the ball up, I don't have anything on the ball to throw it to the infield. And Mix's score easily with the run that Peterson. And I said, I don't need that one again.
Okay.
That's a.
Tom, what about John Frito's catch?
Two men on, right? Eighth inning. The manager hits the ball. And we know it's going to be close to the bullpen. John Frieda goes back for the ball and made a good catch in spinning his body around. He's running like this, and he turns his way around and catches the ball there. That was a good catch, darn good catch. But if he had cut across here and looked out here, picture this. Here's the ball, and the ball is over there. If he runs over and he times the thing, he's got it right here. But he overran it, now he's got to turn around and catch. That made a remarkable catch.
It made it look better than it was, and they don't,
yes,
have, to, they don't have to take to really
that's
show
right.
That down with
he overran the ball, and it was remarkable how he recovered. Yeah, I give him credit for that.
Tom, what did Joe do when he caught it?
Oh, yeah.
Kicked it.
And I saw it, man. I said, I thought right away, you don't see that very often. The display like that.
He kicked the dirt, didn't he?
Boy, like that. Of course, he wanted that. Gee, that's going to tie the score up 8-8.
But you guys won at the end.
Yeah.
Okay. 1948, you led the league in triples again. This time 14.
You know what?
Still
I
batting
48.
Still batting second?
Oh yeah, quite a bit. Quite a bit. I drove in 92 runs, I think. Most of the season I hit second. And George Weiss is arguing with me about I didn't have too good a year. I didn't drive in 100 runs. I said, let me tell you something that I know. I'm hitting second, I drove in 92 runs, and I didn't have a man on third in the last 18 games of the season. In other words, if I want to drive in a run, I have to get a base hit, get hit in second. Well, that's like arguing with God when you know, George Weiss. Oh, I don't know whether I ever told you this, arguing. Your salary with the guy. I'm in there with George Rice and I'm deserving of a nice raise. And we're talking back and forth there. And George, he pulls up, he says, Tom, let me ask you something. When you were a young boy back in Massillon, Ohio, did you ever dream that you would be in a position to refuse this salary that I'm offering you right now. So no, sir, I wouldn't have thought, no way am I ever going to reach this point. I said, now let me ask you something. When you were a young boy in New Haven, did it ever dawn on you that you were ever going to be the general manager of the New York Yankees? Well, let's go on to something else. Oh, you son of a buck, you. Yeah.
Well, 48, of course, was the year where they had the playoff, Cleveland and Boston. Of course, you guys were pretty close in there, too.
Mm-hmm. We got beaten in Chicago and Boston. We got knocked out of it in Boston. We had a chance. If we had defeated Boston, I think we would have been in there, but we didn't. We got beat.
Okay, now you had a good year. You had 308.
Yeah.
48. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I see. I think George fined several Yankees. They had a spy or a tail or whatever following some of our guys around on the road. George Weiss did that. And Bucky Harris knew about it. You know, Bucky's a rough, tough kid. He's been through the mill. And he thought it was ridiculous to put somebody on us on the road. But there may have been some justification for that. I don't know. But anyway, he did it. And we didn't win. No. I call that the year of Boudreau. That son of a buck. He couldn't do anything wrong. Grazzi, he maneuvered, he tried that play, now he's run out of catchers, and he caught. He ended the ball game catching them. The shortstop was doing the catching and got away with it.
Player manager.
Yeah.
Tom, who was Boudreau's second baseman?
Joe Gordon. I love the son. He does too. We've been through that. It's what a guy.
You want to talk about your joke act?
I don't know. I told this to Garagiola. Okay? You know, all of the humor he
right,
has.
Yep.
I told Garagiola, and he heard this. He said, get out of here. Gordon and I, you ever hear of Joe Miller joke books?
Yeah.
You have?
Joe Miller, I've heard the name.
Joe Miller. It goes back 100 years. I saw this thing in a bookstore in where you buy newspapers in Detroit. And I come across this and I recognize Joe Miller. Oh, what corn. What corn. So I grab a hold of this thing, I look at it and I say, so I tell Joe, I say, look at this, Joe. And he reads one or two, he says, holy crotch. I says, let's buy that and memorize some of those dumb things. Yeah. Right down his alley. Here's a sample. We're on the train now. And I say out of no place, hey, Joe, what time is it? I don't know. I left my watch upstairs. Aren't you afraid it'll run down? No, we got a winding staircase. Then he goes, get out of here! And the guy's on the train. Then half an hour later, hey Joe, didn't I see you in Buffalo last week? No, I've never been in Buffalo. I said, I've never been there either. He said, must have been two other guys.